for argument this morning is Parsons Ten and Company against Schwartz. Mr. Mentenban, please.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Ralph Mentenban for the appellant.
Mr. Mentenban, I'm going to begin with a question about subject matter jurisdiction. And it may not sound to you like a question about subject matter jurisdiction, but believe me, it is. The question is this a shareholder's derivative action?
Well, Your Honor, the first person to have raised that issue...
He does that frequently, you know.
I understand that, Judge. I would think so. I would think that the corporation has a vested interest in knowing who its shareholders are, who have the rights to vote at a shareholders' meeting for directors.
Any cases? I mean, this would be determined by Delaware law. Any Delaware cases you're relying on to call this a shareholders' derivative action?
Your Honor, I don't have those present in the courtroom. If I may have 5 days to supply them to the court.
We'll give both sides 7 days to file memoranda on the question whether this is properly a shareholder's derivative action. And let me now tell you that if your answer is correct, this lawsuit has to be dismissed for want of subject matter jurisdiction. Because although the complaint aligns Parsons Tanning Company, the corporation, as the plaintiff, the Supreme Court has held that in shareholder's derivative actions, the corporation must be aligned as a defendant for purposes of determining diversity. That case is Smith against Sperling. It's from 1957. So the correct caption, the correct alignment in this case would be Weinstein versus Parsons Tanning Company. Since both your client and Parsons Tanning are citizens of Wisconsin, the case would have to be dismissed.
Parsons Tanning, Your Honor, is a Delaware corporation.
Yes, with its principal place of business in Wisconsin. It therefore is a citizen of both states. And therefore, there is no diversity. So if this is a derivative action, as everybody has been proceeding so far, and as Mr. Mentenban just told me he thinks it is, this case has to be dismissed for want of subject matter jurisdiction. If it is not a derivative action, it's an interesting question whether it would have to be dismissed anyway because it was pleaded as a derivative action. And normally, jurisdiction is determined on the pleadings. It seems to me conceivable that if it's not a derivative action, the plaintiff may be able to use the privilege under Newman Green against Alfonso Lorraine to dismiss Parsons Tanning as a party altogether. And perhaps your memo should address that question as well, whether Parsons Tanning, if this is not a derivative action, whether Parsons Tanning could be dismissed as a party. But certainly if it is a derivative action, there's no jurisdiction. Anyways, I'll give both sides 7 days. Mr. Mentenban, please proceed.
Well, Your Honor, I have an army with a new adventure. I'd like to do, first clear up some citation discrepancies on page 19. Of our basic brief, the references to the testimony of Curtis Weinstein, which are full pages, they should be added their additional appendix 251. On the reply brief at paragraph 1, the citation should be to additional appendix 273, which cited 273, should be the 286. Your Honor, this appeal relies basically upon this court's decision in Palsy. The court below, assuming it had jurisdiction, was faced with three claims for relief by the plaintiff. It sought an injunction to restrain a shareholders' meeting, to elect directors, and to carry out certain transactions. Its second part requested a declaratory judgment to declare that Michael Weinstein and Lisa Weinstein, and inasmuch as everybody here is named Weinstein, we stay with first names, have no share ownership in Parsons. And the third portion of the prayer for relief, or the complaint, was that Attorney Schwartz had a conflict of interest and that we believe the material submitted to the court in the application for summary judgment shows that he was the architect of the strategy with regards to the maneuvers by Michael and Lisa Weinstein, clearly from a date in 1994 when we have the answers to interrogatories filed in the state court case, which shows that Mr. Schwartz and Michael Weinstein had a meeting to plan their strategy with how to, quote, protect their assets. In this brief, I would like to call the court's attention to a statement by Samuel Johnson. Samuel Johnson, many years ago, said, "Every man wishes to be wise, and those who cannot be wise are almost always cunning." And that's what we have here. The issue in this case is solely, as far as this appeal is concerned, a question of credibility. And that's the Payne versus Pauley decision, which this court is undoubtedly familiar with. In the material submitted,
credibility on who owns the stock?
On the credibility of the persons who tendered affidavits and deposition testimony in support of the application for summary judgment.
Why does it turn on credibility? I thought you conceded that GCI had never foreclosed on its loan. And if GCI hadn't foreclosed, then it hadn't taken a property interest in the security.
No, sir. When the complaint was initially filed, the only documents that we had were the notices of the Uniform Commercial Code Article 9 foreclosure proceeding. But that was several years behind the track. Mm. After the fraudulent conveyance case was settled for $450,000, that's $50,000 more than the judgment, the $397,000 judgment, it was a question of securing repayment to GCI from Michael and Lisa for the money they had taken out. And there's a whole series of documents we refer to in both our brief and our reply brief where Michael concedes that he never, ever paid back the money that was taken out.
I don't understand what matters, why that matters, unless GCI foreclosed on its security, then Michael and Lisa still own the stock. Now, this might suggest that the shareholders of GCI have a derivative action. GCI has left money on the table, but this is not a derivative action on behalf of GCI.
No, sir, it's not a derivative action on behalf of GCI, but Curtis Weinstein testified that in November of 2002, that was 2 years after all this started and almost 3 years after the commencement of the UCC foreclosure proceeding, an oral deal was made between Richie Weinstein and Michael and Lisa where the indebtedness then due to GCI was forgiven in exchange for their stock. The curious thing here is that nobody had a certificate, nobody had any documentary evidence that they owned any shares. They all treated the stock in...
Nobody had any documentary evidence?
No, sir. It's a strange family, Your
Honor. You mean that Parsons Tanning does not have books showing who its shareholders are?
Mr. Schwartz, who represented Parsons in 1995, claims to have had the shareholders books and the stock record book, never produced the original shareholders book, the stock record book.
That's a different question, whether originals have been produced in the litigation. Is it your position that there are no such books?
There's no books that we have possession of, Your Honor. I don't know whether the books exist or not. But one point, Your Honor, that I think is really telling is...
If there aren't any, I don't think Parsons Tanning is a corporation. It's a partnership. And if it's a partnership, we've got even worse jurisdictional problems.
Well, Your Honor, the parties for more than 20 years have treated it as a corporation.
I'm sorry. It doesn't matter what they have treated it as. It matters what it is. Maybe we need to address this as well in the supplemental memoranda. Is this thing called Parsons Tanning Company a corporation or a partnership or something else, a limited liability company or whatever else it might be? But if it doesn't have stock record books, I don't see how it can be a corporation. Anyways, go ahead.
Mr. Schwartz testified that he had the stock record book and he had the minute book, didn't produce them. And, Your Honor, probably what I view as one of the most telling things in the whole record is that item at Exhibit 1 in the additional appendix, where Mr. Michael Weinstein, after retaining James Schwartz, files a sworn bankruptcy schedule listing no shares in Parsons Tanning, listing no interest in either the upper farm or the lower farm, and claims now, in this case, in the application for summary judgment, that he's always been a shareholder of Parsons Tanning Company and that he's always had an interest in the farms, the lower farm that was sold, in which he concedes that he received substantial amounts of money. The other point is Mr. Schwartz testified that he had never participated in representing Michael in a bankruptcy proceeding. And if Your Honor would look at additional appendix page 27, Your Honor would see that Mr. Schwartz filed an affidavit with the bankruptcy court acknowledging that he had received a $10,000 retainer to represent Schwartz, required me to represent Michael in the bankruptcy proceeding. The material that was furnished to the district court shows that on January of 2000, in preparation for the UCC foreclosure, Richie declared to Lisa and Michael that you in 1996 had borrowed $100,000 and you have not paid it back and we want you to pay it back. This was followed in 2001, the document of additional appendix 153, that on March 22nd, Mr. Schwartz writes to counsel for GCI, and he says, as per our many telephone conversations, you are aware that we represent Michael and Lisa with regard solely to disputes regarding GCI and loans in connection therewith. Yet in the deposition testimony, Lisa testifies completely that she had no loans. In her deposition testimony, in additional appendix 196, page 197 of her testimony, line 22, she testifies unconditionally, I have never taken a loan from GCI. Mr. Schwartz testified, the affidavit in the bankruptcy court notwithstanding, an additional appendix page 220, that's his transcript at page 42, line 16, were you ever employed by Michael with regards to a bankruptcy proceeding? And without qualification, he says no. Then as far as the evidence that was before the summary judgment judge, there's Curtis Weinstein's testimony, which is unconditional, That's at the additional appendix, page 251. That's the page I called the court's attention at the commencement of my argument. He says the other issue was, this is Curtis's testimony, the other issue was the additional $175,000 mortgage that Richie had promised me that Jim Schwartz was going to perfect on behalf of GCI, and an additional $35,000. So at this time, we were totaling about $450,000 of monies that Michael and Lisa had taken from GCI, and that's what I was referring to. And then Curtis continued on his report that they had made a deal, and all the indebtedness of GCI was forgiven in exchange for their abandoning their Parsons stock to GCI. So the shareholders that the court below should have declared were GCI, Richie Weinstein for 25%, Curtis Weinstein for 25%, and GCI held 50%. We believe the shareholders of GCI would prove to be Curtis Weinstein, Richie Weinstein, mm-hmm. and their stepmother, Joan
Thank
Weinstein.
Thank you, Mr. Mattenband.
Your Honor, I would trust that...
Thank you, counsel.
I just noticed.
Mr. Stebbins.
Thank you.
Please, the court, Richard Stebbins for the two Weinstein defendants at police. Putting aside the point Your Honor raised about there may have been a failure by the plaintiff to confer subject matter jurisdiction and discussing the substantive issues in the case.
I trust you will discuss this. We've now got three issues on the table. Whether this is, maybe it's really only two, but we need to know what Parsons Tanning is, and we need to know whether this is really a derivative action, if Parsons Tanning is a corporation, as Delaware law would see it, whether this is really a derivative action, as Delaware law would see it. And then there's those are the two issues. Then there's a separate option. Newman Green and 28 U.S.C. 1653 may give Mr. Mattenband an option to dismiss Parsons Tanning as a party. And if Mr. Mattenband exercises that option, we would then have to decide what its jurisdictional consequences are. But that's a kind of contingent issue.
I'll address that within 7 days,
okay.
Your Honor. Thank you. The substantive issue here is the plaintiff sets forth his statement of a claim upon which he believes relief can be granted in the next to last paragraph of his affidavit that he attached to his complaint. He's argued the same thing in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, and that is, he claims, quote, on or about April 28, 2000, I received a notice of private sale which was to be made pursuant to the Uniform Commercial Code from and after January 31, 2001. As a result of that notice and the provisions of the Uniform Commercial Code, the Parsons shares that had been previously owned by Lisa and Michael Weinstein became the property of GCI, unquote. His whole theory of the case is a notice of sale constitutes a transfer of the title in the shares. It doesn't. Whether you look at the Delaware Uniform Commercial Code or the Illinois Uniform Commercial Code, the code is the same. It's the sale that transfers the ownership of the shares. The plaintiff also pleads back in 1991, the ownership of the shares was the four siblings, each owning 150 shares. His whole theory of the case is Lisa's and Michael's shares were transferred to GCI in 2001, and of course he controls GCI. Therefore, Lisa and Michael don't have any right to participate in Parsons' activities.
Were the shares, if they exist, were they pledged as security for a loan?
I'm not sure the format of the security, but it was some type of an Article 9 security interest.
So theoretically, again, if there's shares, if somehow you secure, normally when you borrow money against shares, you pledge the shares and get the money, and you still have voting interest in the shares. But in this case, we're not even sure there are any shares. So I don't know what GCI had as far as security in the loan, and when this notice went out, whoever sent it, maybe they had the authority or the ability to sell them and didn't. But at least is that acknowledgement that there were some shares, I guess, is my question.
What the people thought at that time obviously cannot confer subject matter jurisdiction on a federal court. But for purposes of the substantive issue in this case, they always treated it as a corporation in which there were 150 shares in each of those persons. And that, according to the plaintiff, there was a security interest of some type, whether it was a physical pledge or a UCC financing statement that was in security interest that was recorded. Some kind of a lien interest was given to GCI in those 300 shares that were owned 150 each by Lisa and Michael. Lisa and Michael, under the law, continue to be the owners of the shares. There's only a lien on the shares. And the plaintiff's theory is when a notice of a sale, because they weren't making the payments of the loan to GCI, when a notice of the sale went out, that purportedly transferred the ownership of the shares. That's his theory in his complaint of an alleged attempt to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, and it was his theory in opposition to the motion for summary judgment. And as the district court judge pointed out, he has no other theory. And a notice of sale does not transfer the ownership of the stock. It is the sale that transfers the ownership to the high bidder. And the code requires, Delaware and Illinois version, requires a public sale if it's an item of property that is not readily ascertainable as to value. If it's traded on the New York Stock Exchange, you just look and see what it sold for as a closing price that day. You know what its value is multiplied by the number of shares, and that's the amount you have to credit the debtor for. So you can hold a private sale of something that has a readily ascertained value. But this is 300 shares in a closed corporation, and nobody knows what that value is. So it had to be a public sale. The whole concept of the code under requiring a public sale is to bring in bidders who will bid up the price of the item so that the debtor can get a higher credit. Now, we all know sometimes nobody shows up at the public sale, and sometimes lots of people show up, and it's a very vigorous bidding that drives up the price
public
to the benefit
sale?
Of the debtor.
Was there no buy-sell agreement under these shares?
None that we're aware of. There's nothing in the record indicating anything about that. The shares were given to the siblings.
I can't believe, maybe we'll have to ask Mr. Schwartz, but... Yeah. I can't believe that in a family corporation of this sort there would not be a buy-sell agreement. And it would suggest such astounding incompetence on behalf of whoever created this entity that one shouldn't accept it as a starting place.
Well, the entity called Parsons Tanning goes back many, many, many years when the father owned it and it was an active entity in the leather tanning business.
Well, exactly.
And then he gave these shares to his four children in 1990, 1991, according to the allegation of the complaint. There's no evidence in the record of any buy-sell agreement, and you can see it's a dysfunctional family. But the point of the whole case and appeal is no transfer of the ownership resulted from the notice of the sale. Now, there being no transfer of the ownership of the stock, all of the rest is irrelevant. Those are immaterial questions of genuine fact. They're not material questions of fact. And then the last point I want to make is on the bankruptcy schedule. The plaintiff makes a substantial argument on this point. In 1996, Michael filed a bankruptcy petition, and he did not list his ownership of his 150 shares of stock on the bankruptcy petition, according to the district judge, and we accept that fact for purposes of this appeal. But that still doesn't make any difference, because if, as the plaintiff alleges, what he was doing is, to use the plaintiff's words, parking, unquote, his shares with Lisa so that they wouldn't be available to the creditors in bankruptcy, then he remained the owner.
Yeah. How long ago was this bankruptcy?
1996.
So it's outside the statute of limitations.
Yes.
I mean, what's being described here is criminal bankruptcy fraud.
That's the allegation by the plaintiff. Yes. Yes. Now, we had a response to that, and the judge said there's a genuine issue of fact on that, so we're accepting the fact that there's a fact issue on that for purposes of this appeal. Right. But if he...
Are you contending that there is a factual dispute about whether this interest was listed on his bankruptcy schedule?
Apparently it wasn't listed, but the reasons for it, there's a lot of evidence in the record, and the judge found it's a fact question, and so we didn't even address that issue in appeal because we accept her statement that there is a fact question on that.
About what? What is the disputed issue of material fact on your view?
We're not saying that on that issue there is an issue of material fact here, Your Honor. Okay? We're accepting the fact that it's disputed. Right? Or if we accept the fact...
It's either disputed or it's not. You can't accept the fact that it's disputed.
Let me put it this way.
Are you accepting as a fact that Michael omitted this interest from his bankruptcy schedule and declaration?
That fact, yes.
Okay.
Yes, definitely. Okay. So if he did, and he, what he did, according to the plaintiff, was he was transferring these shares to Lisa because he was just making her a nominee or something like that. The fact is still the same that in order to get those shares from Lisa to GCI, there still has to be a sale in 2001. On the other hand, if Michael continued to be the genuine owner of that stock, there still has to be a sale in 2001 to transfer that stock from Michael to GCI. Either way, there is no event that transfers the ownership of Lisa's shares and Michael's shares to GCI under the plaintiff's theory of the case, which is that it was a notice of a sale, and the notice of the sale doesn't make the transfer. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Races.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Michael Races, and I'm here today for the other defendant appellee, Jim Schwartz. The district court properly granted summary judgment to Mr. Schwartz on count three for two reasons and on two grounds. First, whether Curtis had executed a valid waiver prior to the 1996 shareholder meeting did not present a genuine issue of material fact. It was not disputed, and it has not been refuted, certainly not by anything we've heard today, that Curtis, along with his sister and brother, Lisa and Richie, ratified and approved by unanimous consent all acts and deeds of the corporate officers for the preceding year. And we submit that would necessarily include the retention of Schwartz act as corporate counsel for that meeting. Just as he did in the district court, Curtis simply ignores the unanimous consent resolution on appeal. Secondly, a party seeking to disqualify a lawyer has to show that the legal matters involved in the prior and present representations are, quote, substantially related, close quote. To determine if the representations are substantially related, the courts apply a three-pronged test, a test that the plaintiff does not even try to meet in his opening brief. That three-pronged test is the following. First, the court will look at the scope of the representation. Second, it'll ask whether it is reasonable to infer that confidential information would have been given to a lawyer representing a client in those matters. And third, whether that information is relevant to the legal issues in the litigation pending against the former client. Now, the plaintiff here made no effort to show that Parsons had any interest in Michael's bankruptcy proceeding or other litigation involving Lisa and Michael that made Parsons adverse to them at any relevant time. I want to point out here, in reference to the court's question, that if Parsons has to be dismissed from this case, then quite obviously that would moot out any conflict because the former client would no longer even be a party to this proceeding if the proceeding was not dismissed on the basis of want of subject matter jurisdiction. Now, the district court was correct in its analysis under this three-pronged test to hold that the plaintiff had presented no evidence of an actionable conflict between Jim Schwartz's representation of Parsons in either 1996 or 2003 and his representation of Michael and Lissa in other unrelated matters. We've also raised in our brief a waiver argument that we are continuing to rely on the basis that plaintiff hasn't even cited any cases that have applied that three-prong test or to work within the framework of that test. For all the reasons set forth in our brief, we ask that you affirm the judgment entered on count three. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.